DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, deep and dirty as ever in the world of science and technology. I'm Zulfikar Abani, and coming up, how do you track criminal activity online while keeping people's personal data safe?
If you have a specific activity going on online which is involved in serious crime or child abuse or terrorism, then you should be able to find out who are using those services. But to do that, you don't need to know the email activity of every single person in the country, and that's where the line's got to be drawn.
Also on the programme, transport's a smelly thing, and it can only get better with new technology. And no, it's not Berlin. Dublin's the new Silicon Valley, but can it make a profit? All that right here on Spectrum. But first, privacy campaigners in the UK are up in arms about plans by the government to broaden the powers of the police online. The government says that the draft communications bill, or the snoopers charter as its critics call it, is vital to catch terrorists, paedophiles and other criminals that carry out nefarious activities over the internet. The debate has become perhaps even more potent as ever more details over the sex abuse scandal involving the late and now disgraced former celebrity Jimmy Savile emerge. From London, Robin Powell reports.
New Scotland Yard in central London is the iconic headquarters of the capital's Metropolitan Police. Inside this building behind me, the capital's crime fighters are not only investigating wrongdoing in the real world, muggings, theft, violent crime, but are increasingly having to pursue criminals in the virtual sphere. Paedophiles swapping child pornography online, for example, or the planning of terrorist activity. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, told a cross-party committee in October that the spread of internet and mobile communications threatens to leave the police behind.
95% of serious crime investigations over the last 10 years have involved some form of communications data in every major terrorist investigation. What we want to do, obviously, is to make sure that as the technology develops and people communicate in different ways, they're able to have access to the same type of information on these different forms of communication. If they were only able to have something less than that, that would effectively be the equivalent of a degradation of their abilities.
May is putting forward a bill that gives police and the intelligence services the ability to find out, without needing permission, who in the UK has been sending emails or texts or messages on social media to whom. With permission from the Home Office, they can also access the content of all those messages. In December, a committee specially set up to look into the bill slammed it as misleading and suggested a rewrite. That pleased privacy campaigners, such as Nick Pickles from Big Brother Watch.
Rather than, as the bill proposed, collecting data about every single person in the country, you should be looking to target investigations. So if you have a specific activity going on online which is involved in serious crime or child abuse or terrorism, then you should be able to find out who are using those services. But to do that, you don't need to know the email activity of every single person in the country. And that's where the line's got to be drawn.
Criticism of the bill has also come from the Liberal Democrats, the junior partners in the governing coalition here, and from industry figures who complain that the Home Office didn't consult them thoroughly. Andrew Kernahan is head of policy at ISPA, which represents internet service providers in the UK.
There are some certain developments in the online sector that have meant that, you know, these powers need to be looked at again. I think the way they've been looked at is what's wrong, in that it's far too broad. There's very little detail. The consultation with us was we met with the Home Office, we had some high-level conversations, but the actual detail of what that meant just wasn't there.
Kernahan says this is particularly worrying given the technological difficulties that the bill entails. It obliges ISPs to store a year's worth of internet activity from every one of their subscribers, as well as what's called third-party data from ISPs overseas. Here's Kernahan again.
In a small environment, you probably could retain this sort of data. Trying to do it in the sort of the way that the government wants to do it, that's never been tested, and we're not sure if it's possible in that sort of scale. Third-party data that crosses a network is something that's not retained at the moment. And if that was, I mean, that's a lot of information.
Such problems are less relevant to the general public, though. For the majority, it's a face-off between privacy and security.
If it's for a good cause, then I support it. You know, I need to feel as if I'm safe, even though I may not be, but I need the feeling safe is good.
I think it's out of order. I think it's ridiculous. I think we don't have any freedom. It literally is like Big Brother nowadays, everywhere we go.
If they've got to do that to stop these people from doing what they're doing, then they've got to do it. That's the way I see it. If it's going to stop, obviously, tracking down paedophiles and obviously terrorists, etc., then it's got to be done.
Well, again, it's how much do you trust them, I suppose, it comes down to, really.
So
no, is probably the answer I'd say. I wouldn't trust them as far as I could throw them.
When it comes to trusting organisations with personal data, you could argue that companies like Google and Apple are far ahead of government, amassing data for commercial gain, using cookies to help target advertising, for example. And some are simply baffled by the outcry, like security expert Professor Anthony Gleese. He says the interception of communications has long helped to maintain security in Western democracies, and that the internet is not the unregulated space that some people might want it to be.
The public needs to change its thinking about whether it makes sense to send naked photographs of yourself on the internet. People put themselves at risk by disclosing material on the internet because they think that in some way they can control what's out there. Once it's out there, it can't be controlled. It's out there in indelible electronic ink.
It's already been a long road for this bill. The previous Labour government suggested legislation in 2008 to give the police similar powers. At this moment, the new draft law, or portions of it, are being hastily redrafted. Experts anticipate another flurry of debate in the coming weeks when the government again tries to tread the line between personal privacy and national security. Robin Powell for DW, London.
Well, let's stay in London for a moment now, because the city's been marking the 150th anniversary of its world-famous underground transport system, known lovingly as the Tube, of course. Underground railway systems transport large numbers of people around our biggest cities day in, day out. But back in the mid-19th century, the concept of travelling under the ground was almost unthinkable. However, pioneers in Victorian Britain proved the doubters wrong when they began running steam trains on what is now known as the Metropolitan Line in London, which includes stations, as many of you might know, like Paddington and Farringdon. 25,000 people used the service on the first day in 1863, and now the London Underground boasts 1.1 billion passengers a year. Ashley Byrne's been hearing how it all began and how things continue to change.
It's hard, really, to imagine what it must have been like for commuters on that very first day, on the 10th of January, 1863.
Very scary being underground, I guess.
It would have been mind-blowing. Even if you think of it, the technology must have evolved then, the methods they had, compared to construction methods we've got now.
I just imagine organised chaos, like now.
The journey between Paddington and Farringdon 150 years ago took around 33 minutes, though it did improve to around 20 minutes.
It might be a little quicker now, but not much.
That's Piers Connor, a former tube driver turned transport consultant.
In steam days, they could run 20 trains an hour, which is a train every 3 minutes. And now London Underground runs on the northern part of the circle 28 trains an hour. But the current upgrades will push that a bit further and they'll get past the 30 mark if they're lucky.
Fast forward to 2013 and the revolution that was started in Victorian England continues apace. There are more than 170 metro systems in 49 countries around the world, with the biggest concentration in Europe.
Hi, I'm David Punton. I'm the communications officer for Nexus, the company which owns and manages the Tynemere Metro.
Inspired by its bigger cousin, the Metro sits 450 kilometres north of London in Newcastle.
The Metro trains are powered by electricity. It's an overhead line which makes contact with the train via a pantograph, which drives the trains along the tracks. It's a very simple system and it's very effective. And the Metro system today, on an average day, we get about 100,000 people using it right across Tynemere, especially in the busy city centre areas in Newcastle and Sunderland. The safety features on the Tynemere Metro system is called the Positive Train Identification System, which is a system whereby it makes it impossible for the train to pass a red signal when that signal has gone to danger. If the driver does go past that signal in the very unlikely event, then the track brake on the train will automatically drop and the train thereby stops, so the train cannot pass a signal at danger on the system.
For the London Underground, talk for the future is all about so-called driverless trains. In France, they've spent €1 billion on ditching the drivers on Line 1 of the Paris Metro, and it's estimated passenger numbers there have increased by 750,000 a day as a result. At capacity, they can run trains every 85 seconds. Piers Connor says the London Underground is almost fully automated anyway.
Well, if you take a simple line like the Victoria Line, it has a single control centre. All of the trains are connected to the control centre by radio. They're all automatically driven, although the drivers are on the trains and they look after the doors and the passengers' information systems. Everything is tracked constantly. The power is monitored. The train performance is monitored. So it is, in effect, a fully automatic railway. The only thing that they do have is to have a driver on the train.
But what about the passenger experience? How's that evolving? Well, Transport for London brought in the Oyster card, an electric swipe card to ease the ticketing process for the Tube a decade ago. Trevor Dan is a regular user.
I think they save you, first of all, a lot of money because the journeys are cheaper, but also a lot of time because you now have to queue up to buy a ticket. And also, at the end of the month, you can get online and keep a track of your own journeys. You can see exactly where you've been. Marvellous.
But it could soon become obsolete as ticketing increasingly moves to a swipe system using debit and credit cards instead. Wi-Fi access is improving on the Tube. Virgin Media is gradually rolling out connectivity across the network and making it available on platforms. But what about the prospect of more entertainment on those underground journeys?
There's just not the space. And also you have to think about the advertisers who will pay for it. Would they actually be happy that their captive audience would only actually be captive for an average of 10 minutes at a time?
For Piers, it's congestion, communication and comfort which are the major issues facing underground systems.
In the last 20 years, we've doubled the number of passengers travelling, and this has created a heat problem. And that is a big issue because even if we put air conditioning on the trains, we've got nowhere to send the heat to into the tunnels. So all we'd be doing is making the tunnels hot instead of the trains hot. It's very difficult to say to a passenger during a disruption, when is the next train going to arrive? Because usually nobody knows except the person who's on the train, and even he might not know because he doesn't know what obstruction he's going to meet on the way. So getting better technology, making the technology work to improve information is a big issue.
Despite the obvious improvements that could be made, it strikes me that the system used to work the London Underground is remarkably robust. I wonder if the pioneers 150 years ago ever imagined that their original concept would be such an essential form of transport in so many places for so long.
The next station is Euston Bank Branch.
This is Ashley Byrne for DW in London, England.
Well, if you think that trains can be smelly things, how about this? German and South African researchers in Johannesburg say that they hope to show how methane gas from waste disposal sites can be converted into an inexpensive, environmentally friendly alternative to gasoline. Richard Fuchs has visited a pilot facility that converts the various gases at waste landfills into biomethane as a fuel to power taxis.
Jeffrey never did like the sound of fuel being pumped into his minibus taxi. It was always an expensive experience. That's now history. Jeffrey fills up with methane gas and the fuel is cheap. He does it at one of Johannesburg's most unusual filling stations, located high on top of the East Rand landfill site. The 29-year-old is participating in the joint German-South African Energy Research Project, which produces biomethane from landfill gases.
Most of the times I can spend close to 2,000 something with the petrol during for the whole week. But with the gas, it's less than 2,000 something. It's close to 1,600. Yeah, so I can save close to 700 to 800 with a week. When you drive with the gas, you can see the difference with the petrol. You see? Yeah, so those different, it's a big difference. The petrol is too expensive.
The biomethane fuel is produced in several steps, from gas that is captured from deteriorating waste products. Although he had to convert his vehicle to burn the gas, Jeffrey says the investment has already paid off. Jeffrey has Eddie Cook, the technical director of Novo Energy in Johannesburg, to thank for his fuel saving up to 30%. Cook's company is testing the pilot system in collaboration with the University of Johannesburg and a group of German research institutes. He shows us how the pump works.
You've got your start button.
We'll press it. You'll hear the dispenser telling you it's ready. Then you'll hear the clicking noise coming from the solenoid that's opening from the banks. Then you turn the valve and it starts filling. You basically got three banks. A high bank, medium bank and a low bank. Your low bank has got your larger volume that will basically be filling most of the cylinder. Then you've got your medium bank that will be topping it up. And then your last bank is just the last bit of gas just to get it up to full pressure. So that you make sure that you get enough gas in and that you got the vehicle up to 100% full.
The new technology taps into a South African shortcoming, the lack of large-scale waste separation. The country's waste disposal sites are full of different types of waste, which is broken down by bacteria and produces various gases. In addition to methane, the gases include carbon dioxide and nitrogen, as well as smelly hydrogen sulfide. Combined, they create a dirty and strongly vaporous gas cocktail that, thanks to the new technology, can now be converted into biomethane. The methane content must be 87% for biomethane to be usable as fuel for natural gas-powered vehicles. That's a level that Eddie Cook's pilot facility already far exceeds. In the coming years, Eddie Cook hopes to see up to 5% of all vehicles in South Africa powered by biomethane produced from waste. Although methane is considered a climate-altering greenhouse gas, he says it can be used safely too.
If methane is released without actually combusting it, it is a negative affecting to the ozone, but we actually use the energy value of the methane, combust it in a controlled environment inside a vehicle's engine, and by that using the energy of the methane is then changed over to CO2 and water, which is the combustible products of the methane, which is not as harmful as the methane as such.
Meanwhile, Jeffrey's minibus taxi is now almost filled up and ready to roll.
It pressurized up to 210 bars.
The Johannesburg local says he now has no intention of returning to petrol.
After 5 years, 80% of the people, they will see how the gas work, and then they will see how are we saving. So 80% of them, they will be filling the gas.
Okay. I hope you're right.
I'm telling you, it's the fact. It's the fact. I know.
Jeffrey, a Johannesburg taxi driver, ending that report there by Richard Fuchs. And you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani, on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum. And you can, of course, follow us as ever at DW_SciTech.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
Well, the tiger rears its head again. Ireland is pushing to become Europe's tech leader by 2020. The government there and the private sector have both invested more than €4 billion in the past 10 years into development, infrastructure and other upgrades to attract the best tech startups in Europe. And there's evidence that part of the plan has worked. But can these companies take great ideas and make them profitable? That might require a change in consumer behaviour, as John Sepulvedo reports from Dublin.
In Dublin, there's this neighborhood called the Docklands. It used to be pretty rough, with a lot of crime and poverty. But over the past 20 years, there's been a ton of investment to revitalize the Docklands and turn it into a tech hub. That investment's worked. Telefonica, the Spanish telecom giant, has a large office here. And in that office is a Telefonica subsidiary called Wyra.
Where is a way that Telefonica can place lots of bets on new and emerging digital services?
Gavin Drohan is the deputy director of Wyra. And he says it's a way for Telefonica to find new product lines.
This allows Telefonica to identify new trends early and develop a pipeline of new services.
And Telefonica, through Wyra, is betting on this entrepreneur.
So my name is Cristina Luminia, and I'm the CEO and founder of Thoughtbox.
Luminia is a petite, energetic 28-year-old with curly hair and a quick smile. And the trend Luminia has identified? Teaching children through play. Now, doesn't that sound warm and fuzzy? But let's get real here. Ireland's invested a ton to get tech in this neighborhood, and Wyra is investing in Thoughtbox to be, well, eventually, profitable. So let's look at the return on those investments. First off, for Ireland, with its almost 15% unemployment rate, the question, is Thoughtbox employing people? Luminia says yes, the company employs three people, including Jack Quinn.
So the team is formed of Jack. He's doing digital marketing and he's fluent in French, so he's concentrating on the French-speaking markets at the moment.
To sell and promote the app and also to get a kind of buzz going about it on social media as well.
Okay, so what about the product? What is it exactly that Jack Quinn is marketing?
That's the main screen where people can get more information from the app, meet Scruff, and read a bit about him and Thoughtbox.
Thoughtbox's main product is an educational app that teaches math. Called Numerosity, and it's incredibly creative. Kids can take a math problem and flip the whole thing on its head to help understand the relationship between numbers. And this app, well, it has a great character, a dog named Scruff that helps solve the problems. But most importantly, the app grows with the user. So as the kid gets better at math, the app gets more challenging. Critics love this app, and it's won a ton of awards.
Yeah, so we got the Best Educational App Award and the Best Gaming App Award here in Dublin.
Those were in the Appy Awards, Ireland's biggest app showcase. Thoughtbox also was listed as one of the best 12 children's educational apps by the group Teachers with Apps.
Apple listed us in the best of 2012 hidden gems in 15 different countries as well.
It's been downloaded more than 25,000 times, and it's popular in Spain and Brazil. Now, on paper, everything about this company is perfect, except for one thing, profit. Just a little more than 1% of the people that download the Numerosity trial version pay for the complete version.
To be honest, at first it was a bit frustrating, but then I was looking around and I realized that with in-app purchases, usually the best rates that you could get is about 2.5%.
And according to Carl Zorns, this is very common for app developers. Zorns is an American app developer, and he says there are two problems. First, there are so many apps, the market is flooded with them, that people often believe they can find the same app for free if they keep looking. And as they look, they often get distracted by some other app. Zorns also says people just don't like to pay for apps or the work that was put into them.
I think they take for granted how that you can pick up your iPhone and do one of 20 million things nowadays. I do think people take that for granted.
Zorns has designed apps for media organizations and social networks, including LinkedIn. He does this for a living, and he says a big problem for pricing apps is that so many other people design apps for fun and distribute those apps for free. Zorns says that makes it hard for companies that offer the app free at first, but then want users to pay.
I don't think necessarily, like if you have a trial version and then you have a paid version, that that's a good particular model. But I think having other people use your app and then having them tell other people, hey, look at this new app I've got. It's really cool. It's really fun. It does this one really good thing or these two really good things or whatever it does is what is going to get more people to use your app.
The catch to that is gaming apps. Zorn says people are more inclined to pay for something like Angry Birds than something they think is going to actually teach them something. He says Thoughtbox should position themselves in the marketplace as a game that happens to be educational. And to be sure, Christina Luminia is hopeful that teachers, parents, and kids will want to play Numerosity.
So I'm hoping that people see the value in gameful learning and in gameful education.
And if Thoughtbox can figure out how to do that, get people to buy gameful learning, they'll have identified a new trend, making the entire investment in their company worth it. No pressure, guys. For DW, I'm John Sepulvedo in Dublin.
Well, it's only going to be a challenge for Ireland, the one-time economic tiger. It's got its work cut out, certainly. And so, too, has Egypt, where the economy has been struggling ever since the popular uprising forced President Hosni Mubarak from power. But even in Egypt, it's the tech startups that are trying to turn the tide. Inspired by the revolution and taking cues from companies like Google and Facebook, some are even experiencing a moment of growth. Noel King has this report from Alexandria.
Egyptian entrepreneurs Samer El San and Muhammad Ali started their first company together when they were just kids with a shared passion for computer games.
In secondary school, yeah.
And we started our first company there. We had Islam, his brother, because your mother told you anything you start, you have to take your brother with you. It was gaming.
Produced games, a single game actually, and a single copy, which we sold, and it was returned back.
20 years later, the two men are still working together. What began as a school friendship between two young computer geeks has evolved into a working relationship that's so close, the two men frequently finish each other's sentences. Samer runs a startup incubator in the seaside city of Alexandria, and Mohammed serves as a mentor to young business owners there. The incubator is called Tahrir Squared, a cheeky tribute to the birthplace of the revolution, and it is a promised land for young entrepreneurs. What sounds like a Cairo street protest is actually the sound of a computer game created by Muhammad Ali and based on the revolution. The four startups that the incubator currently supports underwent a rigorous application process. They're mentored by businessmen and professors. They're given a few thousand dollars at a time and asked to meet a series of goals, like proving they can attract investors. Noha El Shazli is the co-founder of Open Days, an online marketplace like Amazon. The idea for Open Days came to her after the revolution, when she went shopping for her children and found most stores had nothing in stock.
I want to buy for them clothes. So I started going for shops as we used to, but after revolution, they were afraid to put new products or import new stuff, especially brands. Our marketing was very bad.
Noha hit the streets, canvassing neighborhoods in Alexandria for small businesses that wanted to reach a wider market. Now they offer their products through Open Days. Samer El San says the role that social media like Facebook and Twitter played during the Egyptian revolution ushered in a new era of respect for startup tech firms. But he worries that many young entrepreneurs have unrealistic expectations.
The Google story. From our side, this is what we hear about the Google story, that two kids left their PhDs and did some code, and then now they're one of the wealthiest people on the earth. They don't hear about the agony and the journey between the technology and the millions, and how they changed this technology to be a business.
The incubator is there in part to help young business owners understand just how difficult that journey can be. And the fact is, most startup businesses will fail. Ali nearly went bankrupt in college after his small gaming company failed, and he was dogged by tax authorities who thought he'd underreported his income.
We need to start fast, and fail gracefully. This is not an option right now. We have to go through lots and lots of hassle to start and more hassle to, like, end something. This really prevents a lot of people from, like, starting stuff and experimenting with stuff.
Times have changed, but the entrepreneurs all agree. Egypt must make things easier for small business owners or risk missing out on what they like to call the next Egyptian revolution. Noel King in Alexandria for DW.
Yeah, and that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. And listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Zulfi Karabani, and I should, of course, say a big thank you to the charming Chiponda Chimbalu, who did a sterling job on the desk while I was away. We'll be hearing more from him soon, I can assure you. Our studio tech was Yaron Kutz. Hope you can make it next time. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.